Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
As they do every 4 years at this time, political appointees begin to depart. In their absence, contractors should prepare for a slowdown in new and innovative project starts. At least that's the view of longtime federal and marketing and sales consultant Larry Allen, who joins me now. And this phenomenon is real, isn't it? The end of term, even if the same guy could get elected, the politicals start to leave in general now, don't they?
That's right, Tom. They really do. And it's inevitable. It really doesn't depend on who's in the White House. Like clockwork, this time of a four-year presidential term, whether it's the first or second term, you see appointees starting to leave, either to go back to the private sector. Some may join the campaign and try to reshuffle the deck. If their candidate gets reelected, they can come back in, perhaps in a different spot. But in the meantime, while you certainly have very competent career managers in government agencies, inevitably, the pace of change, particularly for innovative projects, drops at least one gear. And we're starting to see that a little bit right now. It's not that the meat and potatoes of government work won't get done. That still gets done right now, and thankfully will get done through the end of the fiscal year. But if you're trying to do anything that is closely tied to an administration priority, and then all of a sudden the top one or two people in that agency appointed by the administration leave, well, you know, that could create a question mark.
A lot of agencies, I think, are still evaluating the possibility of TMF funds, of Technology Modernization Fund dollars. And that takes some high-level sponsorship in general, doesn't it?
It does. And you've seen a lot of scrutiny paid to the TMF. And I'm a big supporter of that fund, by the way, Tom. I think that it's something that, used correctly, gives government the ability to break out of its "this is how we've always done it" mode and get into something new. But it does take that top level leadership. It also takes increasingly accountability at the top level for how those funds are spent and the ability to repay at least part of them back to the fund. We know that that's been a major area of congressional oversight of the TMF over the last couple of years. And so if you don't have that, then I think the people who make those decisions on how TMF dollars are allocated will notice that.
And given the fact that appropriations for 2024 didn't get to agencies until halfway through the fiscal year in the first place, maybe the whole slowdown issue is a little compounded. You have the slowing down because of the end of the administration, and you also have the slowness to ramp up because of the lateness of the funds. What's the best course for contractors to keep some action going here?
Tom, I think that's a great question. And if I were advising companies, I would say, while you don't want to totally dismiss those innovative programs that people have been talking about, you might want to take a little more of a cautious approach to some of them, particularly if you know that the leadership in those agencies has been leaving. But there still is money to be spent, as you pointed out. So if it's not going to be spent on those innovative things, it's going to be spent anyway on state of the market, keep everything going, maybe update the programs we already have in place, those sort of expenditures. And if you're a contractor, you should recalibrate your approach to business accordingly.
We're speaking with Larry Allen, president of Allen Federal Business Partners. You're also writing this week that the Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR, acquisitions are accelerating, and they've been growing fast in the last couple of years. Review quickly what they are and what types of contractors ought to maybe get in on that action.
Well, Tom, what we're talking about here is the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR, SBIR in the parlance, because everybody's got to have an acronym in government acquisition. And looking at federal procurement data system spend information, SBIR contracts have gone up 31% over the last 4 years. That's a substantial increase. And what these are, they're really intended to be prototype development sort of programs, similar in some ways to other transaction authority, although with their own special rules and regulations. It's not supposed to be things that are in current commercial production until you at least get to phase three of the SBIR. There are three phases. And, you know, the first phase is to prove the technology. The second would be the prototyping. And the third would be fuller on-time online production before you transition to a regular commercial item acquisition strategy. In terms of the businesses, even though SBIR, small business, is right there in the name, I really think that the SBIR program is starting to get interest from contractors of all sizes. While large business can't really prime a small business contract by definition, that doesn't mean that large businesses haven't taken note of growth in the SBIR arena. It's simply becoming another way to conduct non-traditional acquisitions to try to get around some of the red tape and an increasing amount of red tape that governs a lot of government buys these days. So for that reason, it's gaining a lot of popularity. So if you're a large business, I think, you know, you ought to talk to some small business teammates about this as one of the arrows in your acquisition quiver.
Yes, if you look at SBIR and OTA, as you mentioned earlier, it seems like water is seeking its own level and trying to get some kind of efficient way to get these types of contracts done that is extra far, you might say.
I think that's a really good way to look at it, Tom. And, you know, the idea that you've got all these workarounds, you know, it's like heart bypass surgery. You know, the regular arteries are clogged, but the heart still needs to keep beating. It's the same thing here. You've got a government acquisition system where the traditional lanes are maybe a little jammed up, so people keep looking for ways around, and SBIR is definitely one of those conduits.
And then there is the issue in the far world of increasing demand for data by federal agencies about acquisition, about contractors, about contractor activity, and it's getting burdensome.
It really is. The demand for data in government acquisition is insatiable. And I think there are some clear benefits to the government for data-driven acquisition decisions. However, increasingly, it's industry that is being asked or required to come up with the data and to provide it in a way that's usable to government agencies. That just increases contractor overhead. And what I'm saying here is that it's time for contractors to have an honest discussion with their government counterparts on their need for data, their desire for it, but the fact that, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if the government wants all this information, then contractors are going to have to be compensated to pay for it, because, as I said, it's not like government traditionally turns to contracting officers and says, gather this data. Or if they do, then the contracting officers in turn go to industry and say, gather this data. So it really drives up acquisition overhead and record-keeping burdens for contractors. And if that's something that the government wants, okay, but we have to have a discussion about who's going to pay for it.
Larry Allen is president of Allen Federal Business Partners. As always, thanks so much.
Tom, thank you, and I wish your listeners happy selling.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. And this program note, be sure to sign up for Federal News Network's Customer Experience Exchange, starting today at 1. The online event will feature an array of Federal CX success stories. Today's speakers include Social Security Commissioner Martin O'Malley and the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency's Mark Peckrell. The CX Exchange, today at 1. Sign up at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. And also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going, because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.